Get your rocking shoes, we're gonna rock and roll. Come on, cats, let's go, go, go.
Hi, I'm Bill Gardner, host of Rhapsody in Black. I play classic rhythm and blues from the 40s, 50s, and 60s. Boogie with Bill Gardner every Saturday afternoon from 2 to 4 on KPFK 90.7 FM.
Rock that boogie!
This is Mumia Abu-Jamal from Imprisoned Nation. You're listening to listener-sponsored KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. KPFK, powered by the people.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
Well, good afternoon, friends. Good afternoon, friends and listeners. This is Jim Lafferty, along with my co-host, Maria Hall, welcoming you to this week's edition of the Lawyers Guild Show. Yeah, Maria's back with us this week. She was off last week getting a Heroes Award, and she's deigned to join us again this week, coming down from her podium. And it's good to have you back. Congratulations, Maria. Well-deserved of that award. It is our fall pledge drive, of course, but as we always do now at KPFK, we just take 5, 6, 7, 8 minutes maybe during the course of an hour to urge you to pledge. We hope we don't even have to urge you much, you see, but we do. But meanwhile, we get right to the programming. So, Maria, let our listeners know what they're in for, what they're going to learn if they stay tuned today.
Yes, thank you, Jim. And it is good to be back. So today we have yet another great show lined up for you today. First, we'll be speaking with constitutional law scholar Stephen Rohde about Trump's threats to prosecute his political opponents if he wins a second term. Just how seriously should we be taking him? Then in our second segment, our guest will be international human rights law scholar Marjorie Cohn about Israel's genocide in Gaza, which is now escalating into the West Bank, and the children who are the most vulnerable victims of all.
Yeah, heavy topics, important topics, and I do hope people stay tuned. I think I'm up first with the introduction to our first topic. Listeners, I would just urge you, if you're not regular subscribers, go online, go to your local newsstand, get a copy of the New York Times today, because the headline in the New York Times today reads as follows. Quote, Trump escalates threats to political opponents he deems the enemy. Never before has a presidential nominee openly suggested turning the military on Americans simply because they oppose his candidacy, close quote. The last part of that being the subheadline, of course. That's a shocking statement about some shocking statements of former President Trump. And in a Sunday Fox News interview, he referred to Democrats as a pernicious, quote unquote, enemy from within. He likes to use that term a lot now, that would cause chaos on election day that he speculated the National Guard might need to handle. And in Emily Breslin and Matthias Schwartz's recent piece in the New York Times, they say they are alarmed by how they fear Trump, if president again, will attempt to use the U.S. Department of Justice, the DOJ, to go after his political enemies. And they write, and I quote again, if Trump wins, he can use the Justice Department, including the FBI, to seek revenge against his political enemies, even if there is no evidence of crime, close quote. And of course, in his first term, remember, Trump publicly called for the Justice Department to investigate and prosecute a long list of his political opponents, including Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, John Bolton, list goes on and on, former Secretary of State John Kelly, FBI head James Comey, and so forth and so on. And Trump has promised that if he's elected president again next month, he's going to use the DOJ, he says, to prosecute. Well, now, this time, Kamala Harris and President Biden and Nancy Pelosi. Oh, and prosecute Google because it didn't like its search results about Trump and Harris. And his long list of targets also includes state prosecutors, judges, former officials at the FBI, other staff. So the authors and the New York Times solicited the opinions of 50 former top officials in the Department of Justice and a few retired judges and career DOJ lawyers from both parties, evenly divided from both Democrats and Republicans, to see what they thought Trump might do if he was president again. There are, of course, multiple safeguards in the American legal system, and they prevented the worst from happening during his first term. But they wondered what these experts, together had served under seven presidents, thought might happen despite these supposed safeguards if Trump gets a second term. And the results of their survey were, to put it mildly, alarming. 39 of the 50 said it was likely that Trump, if elected, would order the Justice Department to investigate any personal adversaries he cared to. And of the 50 respondents, 27 said it was also very likely that career prosecutors at the DOJ would follow and do what he asked. And Trump, as a result, of course, of the U.S. Supreme Court's opinion in Trump v. United States, now finds himself basically immune from criminal prosecution whenever he is exercising those, well, undefined core powers of the presidency. Remember during oral argument in that case, when one of Trump's lawyers was asked if that meant Trump, as commander-in-chief of the military, could, with impunity, dispatch a SEAL team to kill his political opponents? And the lawyer said, yes, he could do that. Well, what we've done is invite back to our show today, the Lawyers Guild show, our go-to constitutional expert, to see how realistic it is to have that fear of Trump in his second term, how likely it is that he'll use the Department of Justice, the FBI, and perhaps even the U.S. military to go after his political enemies, go after those protesters he's not approved of, all those undesirables he talks about. Our guest is, of course, Steve Rohde, who practiced civil rights law for almost 50 years. Mr. Rohde is a noted constitutional scholar and activist, the past chair of the ACLU Foundation of Southern California, the founder and current chair of Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace, and author of American Words of Freedom and the book Freedom of Assembly. Steve Rohde is also a regular contributor to Truthdig, as well as to the Los Angeles Review of Books. And I should mention, Mr. Rohde is also a co-host, along with Maria and myself, on the nationally broadcast public affairs show, Law and Disorder. So, Steve Rohde, a warm welcome back to the Lawyers Guild show, my friend.
Thank you, Jim and Maria. To say it's a pleasure is only because of how much I care for the two of you, because this topic should be no pleasure to anyone.
Ouch, is real. It's true. In a recent poll, in fact, Steve, and I think you are already aware of this, I believe, yourself, but I don't know if all of our audiences, if they've seen it, there's so many damn polls these days. A recent poll, 41% of registered voters, Democrats, Republicans alike, said, hey, they don't think Trump really intends to do what he threatens to do in his wild and often incoherent rally speeches. Those are just rants. That's just Trump being Trump, you know? And when he says these outrageous things, talking about prosecuting his political enemies and using the military and such, he's just being bombastic. Yet it's clear from the poll of those former ranking DOJ members and members of his first administration who've been speaking out that they believe he's deadly serious when he makes these threats. What do you believe, Steve? Do you believe Trump is just being bombastic when he says the things he says?
He is being both bombastic and true to his intentions. We have got to take this so seriously. I have three wonderful children, four wonderful grandchildren. I have promised them and myself in this period, and now with less than a few weeks left, to do everything I can to sound this alarm about Trump, because it is no exaggeration that if there had been a radio show in Germany in 1933, and there had been hosts like you and a guest like me, we would have been crying out for the threat posed by this fascist. And we're going to come to that term a little later in this show. And the reason I say that with such conviction is because of the lessons we could learn from Trump part one, the lessons that we should remember, and the lessons he took from his first term. Starting with that, he learned that he's got to demand blind loyalty before he appoints people to office. He's got to array his cabinet and his staff. And even according to the Project 2025 report, changing the rules regarding civil servants so that he gets absolute blind loyalty from everyone. He had a run through for 4 years. And listen, and let's look back at what he did. I mean, he tried, another good New York Times reporter, Michael Schmidt, reported that in at least 10 cases, Trump tried to get the Justice Department. And in those 10 examples, they cooperated with Trump's demand to investigate his perceived enemies. We've got to remember the history that in May of 2017, he fired FBI Director James Comey, and then he ordered White House counsel Donald McGahn to fire Robert Mueller, according to multiple sources. In a rare sign of courage, McGahn threatened to resign, and the second-in-command, Rod Rosenstein, held the line, and Trump backed down on that one. But let's not forget, worst of all, and in the eyes of that survey you mentioned, his most flagrant abuse of power came after the 2020 election. He asked the Justice Department to investigate, quote, sweeping, fact-free claims of fraud, William Barr said. William Barr resigned in December of 2020, writing that Trump had taken a dangerous turn since the election. He was beyond restraint. This is no fantasy of a group of progressives, deluded. This is real, and it's what we have to take seriously.
Yeah, Steve, just a number of scholars on fascism and various public figures have either called Trump a fascist or suggested as much. Former Joint Chiefs of Staff General Miley, has said he's a fascist. And what do you think? That term does get thrown around rather loosely these days, I confess. But is Trump a fascist? Do you think so?
Trump is a fascist if you consult experts on fascism. I was reluctant early on to throw around that term. I didn't want to undermine my own credibility and look like a screaming maniac. But there has been serious study of fascism. Jason Stanley has a book, How Fascism Works. Robert Paxton did Anatomy of Fascism, 2004. I believe there he identified 14 factors. Madeleine Albright has a book on fascism, and many of us from years ago remember Umberto Eco's essay, Ur Fascism, Freedom and Liberation Are an Unending Task. Briefly, the ones that come to mind today are the three pillars of fascism: the demonization of domestic enemies, preposterous lies, and contempt for democratic institutions. Now, this is drawn from the general literature of fascism. And look how, when I said those words, any sentient listener knows that we can apply them to Trump. Fascism creates a myth of victimhood. It targets racial, ethnic, and religious and gender enemies, and usually liberals, as the enemies. Literally the enemy phrasing that Trump used as recently as 24 hours ago is taken from the fascist playbook. In turn, fascist leaders praise their followers for their crudity and their cruelty and their violence. One commentator was reluctant to call him a fascist until the January 6th violent attack on the Capitol and the use of violence. Preposterous lies lie at the heart of fascism, because fascism is an anti-intellectual, it's an anti-science, it's an anti-logic frame of thinking. So you need lies to substitute for all of that. And finally, you've got to undermine democratic institutions, because those are the bulwark that stand against fascism. And so it's elections and the rule of law, and violence is a prerequisite of fascism, as we've seen. No one who takes this seriously should have any reluctance in calling him a fascist, and that the programs he's outlined for his next administration are fascist at their heart.
I wonder, Steve, too, might Trump not be all the more emboldened to take unprecedented actions against his enemies and the law of the land in light of the Supreme Court's fairly recent ruling in Trump v. United States, you know, giving Trump as president virtually free-reigning power to do whatever he claims are the core powers of the presidency?
This is a very dangerous cocktail, mixing what the U.S. Supreme Court did on July 1st in granting Trump, purportedly all presidents, absolute immunity when it comes to these so-called core powers, none of which the court defined with clarity, leaving it to lower courts and to the chaos of future litigation to figure that out, and even partial immunity for other powers. This was literally a get-out-of-jail card, because Trump is currently indicted on 91 criminal charges, 34 of which he's already been convicted of. So he does have a variety. Presidents have certain core powers. Pardons are considered by all observers to be a core power of a president. And under this Supreme Court decision, with three of his personal nominees in the majority, pardons could be offered in exchange for political favors or exchange for bribes. Anything that otherwise would be illegal in a transaction is immune in the hands of a president and this president. So when you combine that he's already gotten his preview, he's gotten his blueprint from the Supreme Court, and the case was called Trump versus United States, and that's exactly what it is. So that is a powerful protection for him as he may launch into his next term.
Well, Steve Rohde, aren't there in place longstanding safeguards in our laws against a president taking such extreme political action against his political opponents? Or is it simply the custom that presidents should not do certain things in a democracy governed by the rule of law?
Sadly, it is custom, norm, and good faith. Everything that has been predicted that he may do, and that we'll also talk about shortly in this program, is legal in the strict legal sense that there are no laws that prevent this. We have, for all of the presidents until him, Nixon being a slight exception, as he tried to weaponize the Justice Department and the CIA and elsewhere but he had to resign in the face of impeachment. But these have been norms since the presidency of George Washington, that there are certain things a president should not do. A president should not influence and intimidate the independent Department of Justice. And Biden has done that all the way to the point of saying he wouldn't pardon his own son, who has now been convicted. So, but we relied on those norms. We relied on those customs because we expected presidents to act with a degree of integrity, of self-restraint. And that is all gone when it comes to Trump.
Yeah, and I wonder, Steve, then, if you couldn't perhaps explain to our audience how, if he so desires, and he apparently does, how he might go about doing that, doing what those folks who surveyed those 50 former top officials from the Justice Department, a majority thinking he would indeed do. How does he go about getting the DOJ to bring politically motivated prosecutions against his enemies? How does he put the groundwork for it? Talk to us a bit about how that might look in reality.
Right. And I am indebted to that New York Times article you alluded to that was published in their magazine on October 6th, because they did the best job. I've studied this entire area, but they did a good job of saying there are four steps that the president could take. He can nominate loyalists, including an attorney general. He could replace the FBI director, Christopher Wray. He then could begin to fill vacancies. Now, some of them require Senate confirmation, but people may not know that up to 300 days after the start of an administration, one can appoint people without Senate confirmation. Then those appointees can change the internal Justice Department rules that limit contact between the department and the White House, and he can issue executive orders removing civil service protections. Then he could move into step two. He could order the Justice Department to open an investigation of anyone, Nancy Pelosi, Kamala Harris, Joe Biden, or anyone else. And then his Trump-appointed attorney general could tap an official in the criminal division or a special counsel or a U.S. attorney. Could they base this on baseless terms? Yes, because it only is a minimum threshold of what it means to launch an entire investigation. Justice Department members could resign in protest. They could leak information to the press or notify Congress, but there probably are, and we know from history, career prosecutors who are currying favor in the Republican Party who would follow his wishes clearly. Now, you might say in step three that the judiciary would be a check, but they've appointed 174 trial judges across the board, especially in Texas and Florida, and they could pick and choose the venue and the jurisdiction to bring these investigations and potential prosecutions. They could find favorable judges like Aileen Cannon in Florida, who already fired Jack Smith, and they could issue search warrants and deny defense motions. And finally, even with a guilty verdict, the appeals process. There are scores of Republican Trump appointees in the appeals court, and then it would end up in the Supreme Court with six conservative justices. So very briefly, that is all possible under existing law, and that's what we face.
Well, Steve, I understand you recently visited Greece, that beautiful place that is considered the birthplace of democracy. What lessons did you learn that are relevant to the times we're living in today here in the United States?
Well, thank you, Marie. I know I told you about that trip and I previewed some of these ideas because I was so concerned by the history that civilizations come and go. Democracies have come and gone. Pericles tried to have his democracy in Greece. Now, democracy in Greece, they had slaves, only propertied males were in the city councils. But then we have ego, power, greed, and the division of societies. And all of those factors led to the fall of that democracy and later the Roman democracy. And these civilizations I was fortunate enough to study in this trip to Turkey and Greece and Cyprus and elsewhere. And it was just a reminder, as is the reminder of Nazi Germany, that sophisticated culture and societies can fall into the sway of these authoritarian leaders. And that's what we face here today.
Yeah, and of course, Trump has been with us long enough now and ranting long enough that it's no wonder that people don't take him seriously in a certain sense. They've become numb to it and somehow assume that this is just bombast when it's pretty clear, as you've outlined and as others have outlined, that's not the case. He's proven that's what he wants to do. So we just have just a few minutes left, but I want to ask you, given the closeness of the election today, the very real possibility, chance, who knows, whether Trump will be the next president or not, what would you say in broad strokes we ought to be doing, Democrats and Republicans alike, who care about our democracy, who care about the rule of law, what we ought, forgetting who you're going to vote for, we don't get into that in this show, but the movements, the people that have traditionally been in the street over one issue or another because they care about justice, because they care about democracy, what do you think their role is and their challenges in this period ahead, including if Trump does become elected and does begin to do as you've described?
Well, I think it's going to be all hands on deck. I think we're going to have to perhaps have the Lawyers Guild show on twice a week. We are going to have to organize. We're going to have to engage in mass demonstrations in the streets to get across to the entire American public, if Trump is elected, that exactly what we feared is coming to pass. We've got to support those institutions that stand for something. Of course, it does start with elections, and it's down ballot elections as well. It's in the Congress and in the Senate, and to forestall what a Trump administration might mean. But it's also elections, and we've seen what the Republicans have done in school boards and city councils and state legislatures. So I think elections and democracy are not about one day. It's not all about November 5th. It's about November 6th and every single day thereafter. And we've got to take democracy seriously. It is only in our hands when this kind of threat is posed. And we've got to inform ourselves. And an informed citizenry is an answer. It's an antidote to fascism. That's why a free press is important and freedom of speech is important. It's why I'm exercising my free speech. It's why you guys on this show and Law and Disorder are being an independent form of freedom of the press. And finally, I want to say, if the other person is elected, we still have our work cut out for us. We are still going to have to be the loyal opposition to policies in a Kamala Harris administration that we disagree with, whether it's in Israel and Gaza, whether it's domestically as far as immigration is concerned and civil liberties, the death penalty I'll mention in this setting and elsewhere. So there's no resting. There's no resting place after this election, no matter what happens. And I'm just proud that something like KPFK exists and independent media exists. And that's my softball for your fundraising pitch today.
Well, thank you. No, thank you for that, Steve, because we are sadly out of time and do have to spend a minute or two doing that right now.
And Steve talked me into pledging right now.
He talked you into pledging right
he
now.
Did.
Well, Steve, before we let you go, tell people where they can follow your work.
Yes, I do this work because I publish at Truth Dig, at the LA Progressive, at the LA Review of Books. A simple Google search will find all those recent articles, one of which is on the election. And I am proud to tell your audience that this Friday I turn 80 years old. I am alive. I know you're blazed the path ahead of me, Jim, but I'm alive and kicking, and I insist on doing this work because of how important the issues are at stake.
Steve, thank you so much. And thank you for that quick little softball, as you say, about our pledge drive right now. In a couple of minutes, we're going to turn to our next guest. But before we do, we want to remind you, if you like what you heard in this last half hour, well, I mean, if you like the fact that you could hear it, that you could hear this straightforward, no punches pulled talk about what the threat is to this country and why. Realizing that's not where you hear everywhere else. That's not what you hear on corporate media, necessarily, whether it's Fox News or, for that matter, CNN. If so, we'd appreciate a pledge. We don't spend long times pledging anymore, but we really need your support, my friends. The very fact that we spend so little time now during our shows making these pledges is one reason why we find ourselves behind the eight ball often financially. So you just need to give us a call at 818-985-5735. There are lots of ways we say thank you. You can get Ta-Nehisi Coates' new amazing book for $150. You can get for $60, you can get it $75, excuse me, you get that whole Fleetwood Mac program that Maggie LePeak put on. That was just wonderful. Two CDs with Fleetwood Mac. $75, my God, there's for $100 you could get Yes, I Glow in the Dark. It's a funny title, but it's not a funny book. It's written by Libby Hadavy, who lives, as it turns out, a mile from Three Mile Island, and the subtitle of the book is A Mile from Three Mile Island and from there to Fukushima. It's all about the nuclear danger, which people are thankfully paying more and more attention to. That's $100. What did you get? Because I know you just pledged, Maria. What did you do?
Well, I can't say because it's a gift for a family member.
Oh, you can't say. All right,
who listens? Yeah. Who does listen?
And the last thing I'll say before we turn to our next topic, and I say this every week during when it is pledge drive time, and that is that KPFK, Pacifica Radio, is unique. It's even unique among public radio stations. We don't take corporate underwriting. We don't get lots of money from the government or anything like that. It's just your station. And how critically important that is to the progressive movement here in Los Angeles. We have on representatives of that movement all the time, people who never get on the mainstream media to talk about their demonstrations, to talk about their work, to talk about their organizing efforts at city council to do the right thing for tenants' rights or whatever it is. They thank us all the time for kind of being their one place, this progressive movement, where they can speak to the people of Los Angeles and engage them, you, our listeners, in their work. So when you contribute, when you pledge to this station, you are contributing not simply to us continuing on the air, but continuing on the air to be a spokes place for the progressive movement in LA, for God's sakes.
Yes.
That's how
and
critically
for,
important.
And for the listeners, because this is not the time to give in to that urge to isolate yourself and hide under the covers. This is a time when we need each other, and we are going to need to find courage. We're going to need to hear people like Stephen Rohde, who's not afraid to put himself on the potential firing line there. I hope I am speaking with hyperbole, but we're talking about political opponents and people who are not afraid to speak up against the powers that be. So to me, I do get courage from his courage. So I hope that you will see from all of our guests, we have amazing guests here. We hope you appreciate it. We hope that you feel a part of it. And get on the mailing list, get on the KPFK mailing list, check out some of the other local news sources like LA Progressive, you know, these news sources where you can see what's going on from really independent critical thinkers.
And for $25, you're a full-fledged member of this station and on that mailing list and what have you, and chances to win prizes. And, you know, all public stations do that. But whatever you do, do either go to our website, kpfk.org right now, or call us at 818-985-5735. Make your pledge in any number of ways that we say thank you. When you do, we hope that the station itself is thank you enough, but we go beyond that. We need you. We need each other. Let's stand together during this very perilous time. Let's now move on to our next guest, who is going to also talk about a topic that isn't generally discussed the way she will be free to talk about it here on Free Speech Radio. Maria?
Yes.
I am very sorry. This is KPFK. It's 90.7 FM here in Los Angeles, streaming worldwide at the web at kpfk.org. Maria, introduce our next guest. Let's get to it.
Yes, thanks, Jim. And this, speaking of courage and people who are not afraid to put themselves out there. Yes, we have Marjorie Cohn coming up. Let me give a brief background about what we're going to be discussing this segment. So in 1932, journalist and pacifist in Germany, a man named Kurt Tucholsky, fashioned a fictional diplomat in a story who says, I quote, "The war? I cannot find it so bad. The death of one man? This is a catastrophe. Hundreds of thousands of deaths? That is a statistic." End quote. And I know that sometimes people attribute that to Stalin, but I did my research and it looks like Kurt Tucholsky was the original, speaking satirically, but unfortunately, to every witticism is a bit of truth. And indeed, as we enter a second year of unrelenting military attacks in Gaza and now into the West Bank, one cannot help but wonder, are we becoming desensitized to the brutality of war and human suffering? And if so, at what cost? Our guest today is someone who has committed her life to not becoming desensitized to war or its brutality, and who always calls out abuses of power wherever it's found. Today, she'll be talking us through how Israel's military assaults in Gaza, which have escalated now into the West Bank, impact those most vulnerable, the people on the ground who live there, and especially the children. Our guest is Marjorie Cohn, professor of law emerita at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law and the former national president of the National Lawyers Guild. Marjorie is the dean of the People's Academy of International Law, and she serves on the boards of Assange Defense, Veterans for Peace, and the Bureau of International Association of Democratic Lawyers. Her books include Drones and Targeted Killing, Legal, Moral, and Geopolitical Issues. And Marjorie is a regular contributor to truthout.org. Marjorie Cohn, a warm welcome back to the Lawyers Guild show.
Thanks for having me, Maria and Jim. Happy to be here.
Great. Well, your recent article in Truthout describes Israel's attacks in Gaza, which are now spreading into the West Bank. In broad strokes, what can you tell us about the region, the geography of the West Bank, the people who live there, and the number of people at risk? And importantly, what is the Israeli government's stated purpose?
Well, the Israeli occupation forces have extended their genocidal campaign in Gaza to the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem. They're using drone strikes, troops in armored vehicles, and bulldozers. And their regular raids since October 7th of 2023 have escalated into extensive and deadly attacks. They've launched what is called Operation Summer Camps, which is a major military invasion in the northern West Bank. So bulldozers tear up the streets, demolish businesses, pharmacies, schools, the soccer field, trees in the middle of the road. And since October 7th of 2023, the Israeli occupying forces have killed at least 754 Palestinians, including a minimum of 166 children in the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem. In Jenin City, approximately 70% of the roads have been damaged or destroyed in the attacks. Electricity, internet, telephone lines have been shut down, water and sewer lines cut, leaving about 80% of Jenin with no running water, including the main hospital. And medical facilities in the West Bank, in the occupied West Bank, have been attacked. The World Health Organization has documented 520 attacks on healthcare facilities between October 7th, 2023 and July 30th of 2024, resulting in the killing of 23 people and injuring 100. The UN Special Rapporteur for the Occupied Palestinian Territory, Francesca Albanese, warns that, and I quote, "Apartheid Israel is targeting Gaza and the West Bank simultaneously as part of an overall process of elimination, replacement, and territorial expansion," unquote. And likewise, Josep Borrell, the European Union Foreign Affairs Chief, said, "Without action, the West Bank will become a new Gaza, and Gaza will become a new West Bank as settlers' movements are preparing new settlers." About 700,000 Israeli settlers live in about 250 illegal settlements in occupied East Jerusalem and what is called Area C. So the West Bank is divided up into three areas. Area A, about 18% of it, is controlled by the Palestinian Authority. Area B, about 22% of the West Bank, is jointly controlled by the Palestinian Authority and Israel. And Area C, which is 60% of the occupied West Bank, is under Israeli control.
You know, Marjorie, one of the worst tragedies, of course, that any of us can imagine is death of a child. And you recently interviewed a representative from Defense for Children International Palestine. And you interviewed him about a new report, a new and really shocking report, showing how Israel's attacks in the West Bank are increasingly targeting children. And I emphasize that word targeting. In other words, yes, we've known that the children and women and children and civilians of all sorts get caught up in the war that's going on in Israel. But this is a report that talks about the actual deliberate targeting of children and doctors talking about seeing more and more children with a single sniper shot to their heads. Tell us about this devastating and shameful report.
Well, Jim, the Defense for Children International is the only Palestinian human rights organization specifically focused on children's rights. I should also say they're a plaintiff in a federal lawsuit brought by the Center for Constitutional Rights on behalf of Palestinians against Joe Biden, Secretary of State Antony Blinken, and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin for complicity in genocide and failure to prevent genocide in Gaza. The new report is called Targeting Childhood, and they found that 20% of all Palestinian children killed by Israeli forces or settlers in the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem, since the year 2000 were killed since October 7th, 2023. And they are specifically, the Israeli occupation forces are specifically targeting children. 90% of Palestinian children have been killed with live ammunition fired by Israeli forces or settlers, and they were shot in the head, torso, or in multiple areas. Shooting a child in the head or torso demonstrates a clear intent to kill. And many of these children were shot by Israeli snipers from great distances, in some cases 1,000 feet away, also indicating that they were targeted. Palestinian children have been shot and killed by Israeli forces during demonstrations in solidarity with the Palestinians in Gaza. Some of them have been shot with expanding bullets, which expand inside the body upon impact and cause massive internal bleeding. By the way, the use of expanding bullets is a war crime.
Yeah.
And Israeli forces deliberately prevented injured Palestinian children from receiving medical care by detaining and firing live ammunition toward ambulances, paramedics, and civilians attempting to provide aid. Children who sustained gunshot wounds from Israeli soldiers to the head or chest, or sometimes multiple locations on their bodies, have been targeted specifically when they're in ambulances. And Israeli drone-fired missiles strike children, leaving them with burns, shrapnel wounds all over their bodies. And Israeli forces have fired at ambulances and paramedics and even civilian bystanders who try to rescue the wounded.
Terry Cohn, doesn't targeting children violate international laws?
Yes, it does. It certainly does. Targeting children with live ammunition violates the basic right to life outlined in the Convention on the Rights of the Child, which Israel has ratified along with nearly every other country in the world. It's also a violation of international humanitarian law and international criminal law. We hear a lot about Israel has the right to self-defense. The International Court of Justice, the World Court, the highest court in the world, ruled that, in fact, an occupying power, and Israel is an occupying power, does not have the right to self-defense against the people it occupies. In fact, under the Geneva Conventions, an occupying power has a duty to protect the Palestinian people living under Israeli military occupation. And yet Israeli forces overwhelmingly fail to intervene or stop or prevent settler attacks and instead protect the settlers, which empowers them to perpetuate violent attacks against Palestinian civilians in the occupied West Bank.
Mm-hmm. Well, Marjorie Cohn, switching from focus more on the West Bank back to Gaza itself for a moment, I'm particularly thinking of the northern parts of Gaza. The Associated Press, just yesterday, the day before, I think it was just Monday, published an article that indicates that Netanyahu now intends, and has announced really, to cut off all humanitarian aid in Gaza, and he hasn't been getting through lately anyway, and has given the tens of thousands of Palestinians who have been, you know, they've been moved back and forth, they're now trying to go there to avoid the bombs of Israel. He's given them a week to get out of there, even though they've closed off many of the exits out. So no humanitarian aid, hard to get out. They're gonna go, they say, and you know, try to get the rest of Hamas. Civilians be damned. What can we expect from such an action? Would it be unfair to say that this is evidence of the truth of the claim? And I think you alluded to this earlier, that Israel's overall goal in this war is to basically, well, rid Gaza of Palestinians, allowing Israel to control the Gaza Strip again. But talk to us about this latest threat or promise, I guess, from Netanyahu.
Yes, Jim. Well, there have been, I think, almost 2 weeks of renewed genocidal violence against Palestinians in northern Gaza, intense aerial and artillery bombardment. Israel is implementing the so-called General's Plan, aimed at emptying northern Gaza of its residents by laying full siege, denying the entry of humanitarian aid, forcing Palestinians to leave, and unlawfully declaring that whoever remains is a military target. Palestinians remaining in the north of Gaza, and they number about 400,000, are being punished for continuing to refuse to follow Israel's unlawful forcible displacement orders. There's no safe space left in the entire Gaza Strip, and Palestinians are fearful that if they leave, they'll never be able to return to their homes and lands. And as you said, Israel's plan is to resettle through the illegal transfer of its own civilian population and annex northern Gaza, and that becomes clearer every day. Around 400 Palestinians have been killed. Thousands more who are currently trapped in northern Gaza are at risk of being killed. Palestinians are being starved to death as Israel continues to prevent humanitarian aid trucks from reaching these areas. And those attempting to flee are being shot at and killed by Israeli snipers, quadcopters, and drones. The streets are filled with dozens of dead bodies and wounded Palestinians, as medical and civil defense teams are unable to access any of these areas without risk of being killed. And the three main hospitals in the north of Gaza are on the verge of collapse. Now, Haaretz did an interview with the former head of the National Security Council of Israel, Giora Eiland, and he said, and I quote, "It's permissible and even recommended to starve an enemy to death, provided you've allowed the civilian corridors of exit beforehand." He said, "Israel's government sees the ability to win in northern Gaza as a first stage that will lead to a permanent Israeli military government, and in the next stage may also be to renewed settlement." And UNRWA, which is the UN agency to protect refugees, has been targeted by Israel. And in this same interview, Eiland says, "UNRWA and Hamas are one and the same." And the interviewer asked him, "There's no famine in Gaza?" And he says, "No, there's no famine." And then he was asked, "How do you live with the high rate of children dying in Gaza that's evident now?" And this is what he answers. "That's how it is. There is a very high birth rate in Gaza, so there are a lot of children."
Wow. Oh, dear. Well, goodness. Switching from the,
bring me to a question about what's the latest on the international community? You know, what are they doing to put a stop to all this killing and suffering, including the targeting of children in Gaza and the West Bank?
Well, on September the 18th, the UN General Assembly overwhelmingly adopted a resolution which was initiated by the State of Palestine, demanding an end to the illegal Israeli occupation of Palestinian territory in accordance with international law, as recently established by the International Court of Justice. And the resolution calls for sanctioning Israel and forbidding UN member states from conducting business with Israel or promoting the legitimacy of Israel's occupation of Palestinian territories. It goes hand in glove with the BDS movement, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, which is a nonviolent initiative of Palestinian civil society launched in 2005, which has been so effective that Israel considers it one of its two existential threats, the other being Iran. And by the way, Jim, I think another purpose of Israel basically clearing out Gaza and eventually the occupied West Bank as well, and which has led to Hezbollah and the Houthis mounting attacks on Israel in solidarity with the Palestinian people, is to draw the United States into a war in the region that would actually directly attack Iran. And one other thing I want to say is that the Defense of Children International in Palestine, at the end of this new report, they listed three demands for the international community. First, an immediate and comprehensive arms embargo, diplomatic and financial pressure to pressure Israeli authorities and forces to end the genocide of Palestinians and the Israeli regime and the Israeli military occupation of the occupied Palestinian territory. Second, investigate allegations of war crimes and crimes against humanity and support investigations by the International Criminal Court. And three, use all available means to demand that Israeli authorities uphold Palestinian children's rights as outlined in the Convention on the Rights of the Child, which Israel has ratified.
Well, we are getting a little short of time, Nilsa, but I did want to ask you this, Marjorie. One can't help but wonder what the Israeli people are making of all of this. And in that regard, and what they know or don't know, a few weeks ago, the Israeli military raided and shut down, for example, Al Jazeera's news bureau in the West Bank, in Ramallah, and because they claimed that by reporting on the deaths of people, including children that you've been talking about, that they were somehow violating national security. I'm trying to get my head around that. But in any event, what does this tell us about the status of press freedom in general in Israel Gaza and the West Bank, and how reliable are the news sources that people are getting there, do you think?
Well, this is a shameless attack on the right to freedom of expression and a crushing blow to press freedom. And I'm using the words of Amnesty International there. Access for journalists to shed light on ongoing events is crucial. And shutting down Al Jazeera's office in Ramallah is a brazen attempt by the Israeli government to limit reporting on their violations of international humanitarian and human rights law. This is clearly an illustration of the extreme lengths to which Israeli authorities are prepared to go to shield themselves from critical media coverage and public scrutiny. Journalists must have the right to carry out their work freely and safely without fear of arrest, harassment, or being killed. According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, at least 116 journalists and other media workers have been killed since October 7th of 2023, making it the deadliest period for journalists since the Committee to Protect Journalists began gathering data in 1992. Israel has targeted Al Jazeera and its journalists, at times going so far as to kill them, as it did to Shireen Abu Akleh, Samir Abu Dhaka, Ismail Al-Ghul, and Rami Al-Rifi. And this is very much in line with the policy of Israel since 1948 to prevent real news about Palestinians or about what the state of Israel is doing to Palestinians, colonizing them and arresting them and torturing them.
We do have to go very quickly before we let you go, because I'm one of your faithful readers. How do people follow your writings and about this?
Well, Jim, as you said, or I guess as Maria said, I have a regular column on truthout.org. Uh-huh. And if you go to the bottom of the Truthout page, you'll see human rights and global wrongs. That's my column, and that will give you access to my articles. And then my own website, marjoriecohn.com, has not only my articles, but video interviews, radio interviews, my books, etc.
Oh, God. Well, I heard listeners follow it. I'm telling you, I follow it. Follow it if you really want to know what's going on. And in the area of international law, and particularly these days in Israel and in Gaza. Marjorie Cohn, thank you. Thank you for your great work and for joining us today here on the Lawyers Guild Show. We do now, with a couple of minutes that are left, want to urge you again, friends, this is pledge drive time. We're passing the hat, if you will. Because, we're a community and we're passing the hat. I'm throwing in, Maria's throwing in, all of our unpaid staff here are throwing in. Staff that are paid don't get enough to throw in. We'd like to give them a raise. It's a one-in-a-kind radio station in here. Pacifica Radio is unique in the country. We're, as I said before, part of the whole progressive movement. Maria, remind our people again, why our listeners again, why we hope they'll give us a call or go to our website.
Yes. Well, more importantly, too, I wanted to say thank you to Sharon from Alhambra and somebody very, I know, close to you, very amazing pacifist activist, Therese Bompain.
Oh, yes, yes,
has
yes.
Given pledges.
Oh, that's just so wonderful.
If you give, you are in great company.
You sure are, my friends. That's the point. We are all in this together, really. And this is a unique station and a unique community of listeners. Oh, some people just hit it as they're driving along the street. But it's a community. And so please, 818-985-5735, or simply go to kpfk.org. There you'll see all sorts of good thank you gifts when you do. There's our theme music playing, so we have to say please. And when you do pledge, let people know you're doing it because you heard it here on the Lawyers Guild Show. We appreciate that. Till next week, same time, same place. This is Jim Lafferty and Maria Hall thanking you so much for listening. Thank you for pledging. We'll be back with you next week with some more stuff that you're likely not to hear anywhere else. Thank you.
That's never been told, so now you see the light. Stand up for your right. Come on,
get up. Stand up for your right.
Hi,
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! In-depth news coverage is becoming a rare commodity in today's media landscape. There's a straightforward reason. It's no longer profitable for commercial media. Serious journalism is expensive. It takes time to prepare. It requires a large and talented team of researchers, reporters, editors, and producers. That's why listener-supported news and information on KPFK is more important than ever. We continue to bring you comprehensive coverage from skilled, dedicated journalists because you continue to support the work we do here all year round. Please continue to support KPFK, all the vital work that's done at this Pacifica station. Call 818-985-5735.